Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, where we meet some of our most influential musicians and take a close look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. Since their very first single, West End Girls, in 1984, the Pet Shop Boys have occupied a unique place in the UK pop firmament. Responsible for some of the most idiosyncratic and successful electronic music ever, their career spans some 10 albums and an incredible 55 singles. They've managed to mix underground dance culture with pure, unadulterated pop and blend art with massive mainstream recognition. There is simply no one else quite like them. And my guest this week is Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys. And I started by asking Neil when he first became aware of music.
I was aware of music from as long as I can remember. There was always the radio playing in our house, what used to be called the Light Programme, which was now what you call BBC Radio 2. When we were very small children, we'd listen to a programme called Uncle Max, which was on Saturday mornings. And Uncle Mac played songs like Nelly the Elephant, do you know that song? As requests for very, very young children. And on Sundays, when we were having Sunday lunch or washing up afterwards or something, you'd have three-way or two-way family favourites where requests were played for British servicemen. And, of course, the great thing about this is that you heard an astonishingly eclectic range of music, and you can hear that eclecticism in all British artists up till the 80s. After that, radio changes and gets less eclectic. So, you know, if you were from the Beatles generation up to the Pet Shop Boys generation, you were used to hearing the Rolling Stones next door to Vera Lynn, and it sort of had an effect on everything. That's why Paul McCartney could write Helter Skelter and Honey Pie on the same album, because of the Light Programme.
Were you always attracted to music?
Yes, always. My sister got piano lessons because she was a girl, and I didn't because I was a boy. But I taught myself. I got a Spanish guitar when I was about 12, and I taught myself guitar chords. And then I taught myself to play the guitar chords on the piano. And then my sister had a book of Beatles songs or something, and I used to play them on the piano by playing the guitar chords on the piano.
What Beatles songs? Can you remember?
I can remember playing Fool on the Hill. Starts with a chord of D6th.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him, they can see that he's just a fool. And he never gives an answer, but the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Well, on the way, head in a cloud, the man of a thousand voices talking perfectly loud, but nobody ever hears him or the sound he appears to make, and he never seems to notice. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round. Tell what he wants to do, and he never shows his feelings. But the fool on the hill sees the sun going down, and the eyes in his head see the world spinning round.
What about the first piece of music that you owned that was yours, the first record you bought, the first thing that you could say, this is for me? It's not the radio, this is purely,
I think,
for me.
I can't remember if it was Christmas 1963 or 1964, but I think it was 63. I got a record token for Christmas from one of my aunties, and I went to the funny record shop that also sold electrical goods in Newcastle called Alderson and Brentnell's, which is very what record shops were called in those days. And I was 9 years old, and I asked for the Sandy Shaw's second hit record, which is called Girl Don't Come. Probably not a title someone would choose nowadays. But and I still like this record. It's a very cool record. It opens with a sort of trumpet solo. Ba 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 ba. Anyway, I still like it.
You have a date for Happy's Day tonight. Some distant bell starts chiming in. You wanna see her. The time rolls on, those minutes fly by. You wanna go, but just to try, guy. You wanna see her. You wanna see her. Oh yeah. So you wait and wait. Girl, don't come.
And that was the first record I ever had. So as I bought it with a record token, the first album I ever acquired was Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles. And I say acquire because I didn't buy it. I was listening to Radio Luxembourg one night. I used to like DJ Simon D, who was very famous in the late 60s. And a girl wrote into him and said she didn't have any money and she thought he should send her a copy of Cat Stevens' new single, which I guess was Matthew and Son or something at the time. And he sent it to her. I was amazed. So I wrote him a letter and I said, I thought he should send me a copy of Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles. And he read this out on his programme. I was listening. I didn't hear it. I didn't actually hear it. My sister told me. And anyway, he read it out on the radio. And he said, I can't just do that, Neil. But I will. And then 3 days later, a copy of Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles, a promotional copy, which I've still got, with a little slip saying, with the compliments of Simon D, arrived at our house in Newcastle. The first album I ever bought, the following year, 1968, when I was 14, I was an extra in a film. They filmed the exteriors of in Newcastle by Ken Russell called Women in Love with Alan Bates and Oliver Reed. And I earned like £15 in 3 days, which was just unbelievable. And I bought the Beatles' White Album because that was the first album I ever bought.
You've made no secret of your love and respect for David Bowie over the years. When was the first time you were aware of Bowie as an artist?
Well, I was aware of Space Oddity. In a way, that's a separate career for David Bowie. But then, at the beginning of 1972, there used to be a programme on Radio 1 called Sounds of the 70s with Bob Harris, who I think is still employed by the BBC. And he used to have sessions, you know. Sounds of the 70s went out, I can't remember, like 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, before John Peel. And he had a session from David Bowie, and also David Bowie was famously on the Old Grey Whistle Test when he did 5 years in Ring Track from Ziggy Stardust, Forge Release, and another song. And I became obsessed by David Bowie, and so did most of my friends, and my brother Simon, my younger brother Simon did as well. And he came to Newcastle City Hall as Ziggy Stardust in June 1972 when I was doing my A-levels. But nonetheless, I took the night off and went to see him. It was amazing. Newcastle City Hall was half empty.
Really?
Yeah, and David Bowie told everyone to come and to move forward. You know, it was one of those, which, you know, it was quite common at Newcastle City Hall. And we were in the fifth row and I just couldn't get out. I thought it was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen and heard. David Bowie had such a strong charisma.
Was that the point when you thought, that is what I'd like to
do? Oh, no, I'd already decided that years before.
Really?
Yeah, when I was about 12. And when I got the guitar, I decided I wanted to be a pop star.
Who did you want to be like at that age?
I guess the Beatles, probably. And then there was a period where I wanted to be like the Incredible String Band. Because in between the Beatles and Bowie, I liked the Incredible String Band. Because a friend of mine was evangelical about them. And I was sort of force-fed them, basically. I hated them when I first heard them, and then I got to like them. And, you know, the Incredible String Band, who still have a sort of following, you know, they were like nothing else. They weren't quite folk music. They weren't pop music. They were their own genre. And that had a big influence on me, because when we started the Pet Shop Boys, I kind of Well, we both did, actually. We both sort of wanted to be our own genre rather than slavishly follow fashion and all the rest of it.
Can you remember the first song that you wrote? I presume you were quite young as well.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly the first.
Cringingly embarrassing lyrics?
No, it was... I started to write songs almost immediately because I would learn a chord, like, say, A minor seventh, and then I would write a song. And I remember writing on A minor seventh, putting the top string up to G and down again to E, a song called She Sells Seashells on the Seashore There. And I was probably 13 when I wrote that.
Did you find writing...
It's not that bad, actually. I could play it now. It's sort of, for me, it's not very good, but it's sort of got that sort of impressionist quality about it.
When did you first meet Chris? That's one of the significant firsts in your life.
It's very significant first. It was in August 1981 in a shop on the King's Road, which only recently shut about 2 years ago.
Called was it?
Chelsea Hi-Fi Stores, I think it was called. And it was where you went if you wanted some hi-fi gear on the King's Road in Chelsea. This is, as I say, it was 1981. And I bought a monophonic synthesizer. And I got it home, and I think I sort of... I'm still a bit like this, a bit hazy about details sometimes. I saw the student had speakers in it, and I got it home and plugged it in. Of course, it didn't have any speakers. I thought, I didn't quite know what to do, really. So I went down to Chelsea Hi-Fi Stores, and it had it needed a jack plug to come out of the Korg synthesizer, and I realized it needed a 2-pin thing to go in the back of my 1970s classic stereo system. And they actually, I don't know, does shops still do this? They actually welded it for me, they created it for me. And while I was standing around the shop, which took, took a while, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, Chris Lowe walked in, who lived on Sydney Street around the corner from where I lived. And I guess he had to wait because the guy was making my lead. And we got talking about music, and he lived around the corner. And a few days later, we met up at a pub over the road from where I lived, the Chelsea Potter pub. And that was that, really.
What were your first impressions of him?
Of Chris? I thought he was funny. I thought he was an unusual person. I didn't really know anyone like that. I still don't, actually. He was a different, not generation, he was 5 years younger than me. And he came from a very different, sort of background. His father had a very similar job to my father. But his attitude to things was very different from mine. He wasn't remotely earnest like I was. And he was a sort of fun-loving person. He liked disco music. And I was a classic sort of new wave fan wearing a grey raincoat and Dr. Martin boots, and he was wearing trainers. But we both liked David Bowie, which at that point was a relatively recent discovery for Chris, I think. Just a few years, he didn't go all the way back. And he liked Soft Cell, and I liked Soft Cell. And I was quite scandalised that he liked the group Imagination. Body Talk had just been a hit. And actually, he was right, because it's an amazing one.
So when did you first get into electronic music, if you'd come from the slightly, admittedly, more glamorous end of rock music and pop music? When did you first discover your Kraftwerks, your bands like this, that kind of became such a big influence?
Well...
Was that through Chris?
No. We both liked electronic music, which is, why we started writing songs together. That's which is why I had the synthesizer. I had a group of friends from Newcastle who I still knew, and I lived in London, which was the core of my friends at those days. And, we had Tangerine Dream. When would that have been? 73, 74. People would have some insanely weird group on Virgin. I can't remember the name of them now. Someone I have Can, whenever he liked. I love Tangerine Dream, though. And of course, there's more unfashionable music. Tomita, Snowflakes Are Dancing, his album of Debussy played on real old synthesizers. It's a great album, still sounds good, actually. And then, of course, right at the same time, you got Donna Summer, I Feel Love. and Kraftwerk, Trans-Europe Express, but particularly the Man Machine. And I remember everyone had the Man Machine. And we were always struck by wondering who'd influenced who, by that kind of digger, 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 digger on I Feel Love and the second track on the Man Machine, this one, that wonderful instrumental. So when I liked punk and new wave and all that stuff, and then when that turned into electronic music, that was an amazing period, you know, particularly, I'd sort of be interested in the Human League, but only sort of, but when that suddenly became a glossy pop project with the Dare album, I just thought it was amazing. I still think that's an amazing album, by the way. And, you know, and Chris Lowe liked all that music as well. So, but I mean, 1981 was a great time for electronic music, Soft Cell, and also for pop production was suddenly changing. The following year, I went to work for Smash Hits, and you know, you had Trevor Horn's productions starting, like Dollar and all those, and ABC, of course. Chris and I both really liked that Look of Love. And also, it was a great time for clubbing music. When I went to Smash Hits, I used to get lots of free records, and that was the, it was that period when the New York stuff started happening, Afrika Bambaataa, Planet Patrol, and all these records produced by Arthur Baker, Freeze at IOU. And I was heavily into that. That and also Chris discovered this record called Passion by the Flirts. But we realised it was produced by a producer called Bobby Orlando. And I discovered in the Smash Hits dumper box, where records no one wanted were hurled, and I used to spend hours going through it, that Bobby O actually seemed to produce an endless stream of slightly cheesy disco records that are also sort of rather fabulous. Famously, I phoned up Bobby O when I was going to New York to interview the police and met him, and we ended up making a record with him.
Well, that record led on to the single that became West End Girls, which seemed, when it came at the time, that it had just emerged from nowhere as this pristine pop single, but it had a life before it did as well as it did.
Well, the thing about West End Girls, which people don't really think about, because often with the Pet Shop Boys, people think about To Go West or something, you know, which is another strand. When we started, we were a mixture of that early emerging hip-hop from New York, European dance music, Italian stuff particularly, with little tinkly melodies, which I would still like now, and pop music. And also a bit of the Bobby O thing was very important too. And I guess you would call that gay disco now. In those days, you used to call it high energy. But all these forms of music were pretty much electronic. I mean, it was that amazing moment where black music in New York suddenly was based on Kraftwerk, Trans-Europe Express. And this was a totally fundamental thing that happened in music. And we were completely inspired by that. So West End Girls, which the lyric of which was inspired by The Message by Grandmaster Flash, was a rap record. And I had the idea that rather than rap in an American accent, I would rap in an English accent. And so I don't think people ever really think of West End Girls as being a rap record because of that. In fact, it was the first rap number one in America. But people, if you made a program about the history of rap, West End Girls would simply not be mentioned because people have an idea of what rap is.
West End town. Call the police, there's a madman around. Running down underground to a dive bar in a West End town.
In a West End town, a dead end world. The East End boys and West End girls. In a West End town, a dead end world. The East End boys and West End girls.
West End girls. Too many shadows, whispering voices, faces on posters, too many choices. If, when, why, what, how much have you got? Have you got it, do you get it? If so, how often? Which do you choose, a hard or soft?
Another first I was to ask you about was the first time you met Dusty Springfield.
That was in 1986.
A legendary voice. A legendary voice.
Well, we'd written this song called What Have I Done to Deserve This? Tom Watkins, our manager, was managing the art career of an American songwriter called Ali Willis, who since then has famously written or co-written the theme song of Friends. And before that, we were fantastically impressed because she'd written a couple of things, famous songs for Earth, Wind and Fire. And anyway, she was in London and Tom Watkins, you know, said, why don't you write a song with Ali? And so we went to the studio. EMI used to have a demo studio in Manchester Square where their offices were. And I had this lyric, What Have I Done to Deserve This? I thought of coming back from Smash Hits one day. I was still at Smash Hits at this point. The three of us wrote this song. It had three different bits. The bit Ali wrote, the bit I wrote, the bit Chris wrote. And Ali sang on it. She sang the bits she wrote, which is probably the best bit, Since You Went Away. And so we were going to put this on the first album, and we suggested, someone in Tom's office said, why don't you ask Dusty Springfield? Because she's always going on about Dusty in Memphis. And we said, oh, wow, that's a great idea. And then no one could track her down. And so we didn't put that on the first album. Then Tom Watkins phoned up one day and said, Dusty Springfield's manager's phoned up and she would like to do that song. And we said, great. So it was the first track we did for the second album, actually. And Stephen Hague produced the track. And I always remember sitting at AdVision Studios waiting for Dusty to come in. We were sitting in reception feeling a bit giggly because it was a bit scary. Anyway, so all would go in and Stephen Hague's chatting to her. She says, what do you want me to sound like? And we said, like Dusty Springfield. She went, oh.
This is Six Music, and you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
1993 era of Can You Forgive Her and Go West. That's kind of, it seems to be the first time that something that I assume has always been a massive interest of yours, the contemporary art, the first time that kind of was realised in form of your personal visual image within the band. Visually, the group changed a lot. Was that a sort of conscious decision to go, we've always loved this part of the arts, let's see if we can absorb that into our visual image? Or are you going to say, no, it was all quite casual and just happened by accident again, aren't you? That's what you're going to say, isn't it?
We've never been scared of being arty. We've always been sort of arty. I remember someone asked us in the early 90s, are you art or arty? And we said arty. And, you know, how that came about was we did the first world tour in 1991, and it was directed and designed by two people from the English National Opera, David Alden and David Fielding. And our American manager at that point, Armour Anden, who were doing this tour, it was in America, it was playing theatres, it was hemorrhaging money, whereas in Europe it played arenas and didn't do too badly. And he said, God, you do all this theatrical stuff, why don't you do it in your videos? We said, wow, good idea. And so when we made the Very album, which was very hyper-pop, and it was a sort of reaction by us to the previous album, Behaviour, which was rather beautiful and slightly melancholy. We asked David Fielding, who's a brilliant designer to this day, if he would design a sort of look, you know, what do you think? And at the song Can You Forgive Her, which mentions school, something about the back of the bicycle sheds or something, he came up with the pointy hats, which he saw of as dunce's caps. We used to be in the Victorian times, you used to be sent to the back of the class and they put a dunce's cap on you, and it was a sort of punishment. And that's when then he designed the orange boiler suits, and we worked with this, I'd been involved with Electronic, Bernard and Johnny, in this single, Disappointed, and this director called Howard Greenhoff did the video. And I think Bernard and Johnny chose him because he'd done the video for Snap, the power. You got the power. Anyway, so we asked Howard, obviously knew about new technology, and we had this idea. Chris has always had this idea of, could we get to the stage where we didn't have to be in the videos, but it would look like we were in them.
So we can go on holiday, basically.
Sort of, yeah. And anyway, we wanted to make digital cartoons, was our sort of idea. And David Fielding again came up with a lot of the concepts for that video, like the egg and all the rest of it. And then Howard really went with that. I think that's one of our best videos, I think. I prefer it to Going West, although Go West is a very good video too. It's just its own world. We are completely in the context of this absolutely created world where it's totally natural for two people to sit in pointy hats. There's a great bit where we're playing some game on a table.
And then we're rowing across the lake
in Battersea Park and on a tandem, you know. So it's an amazing video. And we weren't trying to be art. I think it's a mistake for pop stars or whatever, musicians, to decide that they're art. It is all art, if you like, because it comes out of your imagination or out of other people's imagination through collaboration. But it's pop to us. I think pop is art, really, when it's good, anyway. Or maybe when it's bad, I don't know. And we are trying to invent something new.
You mentioned Electronic, Benna Sumner and Johnny Marr. How did you meet those guys? Because they did some fantastic records.
Well, we were both big fans of New Order, and I always liked the Smiths. It's funny, I remember when EMI appointed a new managing director or chairman, Rupert Perry, and at that time we were their biggest group, and he took us out for dinner, because Chris and I were always complaining about everything at EMI all the time, and we said, we were slagging off EMI and saying, you need to sign someone like the Smiths. And he said, right at the end, he said, oh, I've got to tell you, we have just signed the Smiths. He said, but don't tell anyone. And anyway, then the Smiths broke up immediately. And Morrissey was on Parlophone. And there was that great year on Parlophone where you had, you know, Pet Shop Boys and Morrissey and Mark Almond. It was all happening. Our designer is Mark Farris from Manchester. And he told me that Bernard Sumner was making a solo album, and I said, well, tell him I'll do a track with him. So I said to Chris, will you come to Manchester, because I'm too scared to go by myself. and so we drove down, Chris drove us down to Manchester, and in his Porsche, which he had by that point, and Bernard said it was a boy racer car. Anyway, we started working on this track at Johnny's house, and that was a song called The Patience of a Saint, which was on the first Electronic album. And Bernard had sent this solo album turned out actually to be a collaboration between Bernard and Johnny Marr, and they hadn't redefined it, because I remember saying to them, is this a duo, is that what it is? And he said, yeah, I guess it is. And they were still defining what it was then. They'd sent me some instrumentals on a cassette, and the one I really liked was the one that came Getting Away With It. They had the track, but they didn't have any words or anything, and I thought of Getting Away With It. And it was a very literal way. I was just thinking it was Manchester, and Manchester made me think of Morrissey. And so really, my idea for the lyric of the song is I was being Morrissey.
I couldn't care less. I've been getting tell you, you shouldn't really know. And it's been true. It's been true all my life. I've been talking to myself just to suggest that I'm selfish. I've been trying to impress that more is less and I'm repressed.
I should do what he said.
However I look, it's clear to see I love you more than you love me. However I look, it's clear to see I love you more than
in 1995, you got to work with David Bowie for the first time.
David Bowie came about because I went to see his show at Wembley Arena, the Outside Tour. Mm-hmm. I liked that album he did, last album he did with Brian Eno. And afterwards, I'd passed, he went backstage. I'd never met him before. And I told him, and then he was introduced to him and said, oh, hello, and he was all very charming. And I said, oh, I don't know why I haven't released that song. See, I'm always, as a pop person, I'm always thinking about singles and all that kind of thing. And there was a song on the album, on his album Outside, called Hello Space Boy, which I thought was potentially a great single. And also, I liked the way it had the classic David Bowie themes of a spaceman and also the kind of gender confusion. It's confusing these days. And I said, and he turned round to someone, management or whoever, and he thought that should be a single too, and he'd obviously been told it shouldn't be.
And he tells David Bowie not to put a single out.
Oh, you'd be amazed. You'd be amazed. you'd be amazed what they tell you. And he said, oh, why don't you remix it? I was at home a couple of days later, some friends, and someone phoned up and said, David Bowie's going to call you up. And I said, okay. And I said to this friend of mine, when the phone rings, answer it, it's going to be David Bowie. He's like, what? And I said, and the phone goes, hi, it's David. Anyway, so we agreed we'd do it. So we got all the stuff, the parts sent over, went to the studio with our engineer, and Chris came up with a new sort of electronic rhythm track. And David Bowie's song only had one verse. Space Boy, you're sleepy now. And it went into, it had a very interesting and strange structure. And we needed a second verse. And we didn't know how to get in touch with David Bowie because we didn't know where he was. And so I think Chris said, well, why don't you do the cut-up technique? And I said, that's a great idea. And I thought, it mentions Major Tom. It doesn't mention Major Tom. I thought, it's Space Boy. Let's bring Major Tom into it, who was in Space Oddity and Ashes to Ashes. And so I cut up the lyrics of Space Oddity. So it was ground to major, bye bye Tom, or something, I can't remember the words on it. And it mentions Major Tom. And then David Bowie, for the phone rang, was David Bowie. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, we needed a second verse. So he goes, oh yeah. And I said, so we've cut up the lyrics of Space Oddity. And he said, oh, yeah. And he said, come up with anything interesting? And I said, well, we thought it should be about Major Tom. And I was just imagining that Major Tom's in one of those Russian spacecraft that they can't afford to bring back anymore. And he said, to which David Bowie said, oh, that's where he is. Anyway, and then he said, sounds like I better come in. And he didn't sound very happy, actually. And he came in. He suddenly arrived at the studio by himself. Studio in Primrose Hill. And I sang, because he was meant to sing it, I sang the verse. I'd sung it and recorded it, and I said, this is the new verse. We were a bit nervous, you know. And whilst we were turning it to a pop song with Space Boy, hello, hello. And it was quite different from his version. Anyway, he roared with laughter, and he said, oh, it's great. He said, it's great, but you've got to sing it for me. So we left me in it, which I wasn't meant to be in. And he went and sang some more of that record. It was great, because he said, what voice do you want? And I said, Cockney. And so he's going, Spice Boy, you're sleepy now. And I thought it was, and then it became a single. We did, the Brits with them, actually, and Top of the Pops with them. And that was that.
Do you want to be free? Yes, I want to be free. Hello, Spice Boy.
You've got the greatest hits coming out. I was going to ask you, does it feel like a full stop? Have you got any intention of stopping working as the Pet Shop Boys?
No, for some reason, I remember when we first brought our greatest hits. This is our third greatest hits in 25 years.
Not the first.
I don't think it's the third, so I don't think it's that bad. I'm sure we'll bring another one out in about another 7 years' time. And of course, the reason you bring out our greatest hits is to try and get the people who wouldn't buy your records normally. Who aren't part of your supposed fan base. It's a sort of an evangelical thing, really. but for some reason, with Greatest Hits, people think that it's a full stop. I think to the artist, it doesn't seem like that. That's why so many Greatest Hits are called the best of so far, things like that. Because you're saying we're not splitting up. Because, but, and it's funny that people think that, because I don't think artists really think like that.
Have you ever come close to splitting up?
Yeah, because in the course of this interview, we seem to have had sensational triumph after sensational triumph. whereas, in fact, the reality is
lurching
that,
from one disaster to another with a sheen of success over the top.
not quite. There's Chris's famous phrase when we were leaving some festival he thought wasn't going to work out for us. He said, it wasn't quite the disaster I was hoping for. A lot of it's a struggle. People nowadays, even I, you can sort of think, oh, you know, in the 80s, everything he did was a hit record and all the rest of it. And actually, it was one long battle from start to finish. We used to spend every day battling about how you're going to be presented on the television, and how you didn't want to be on the doing some horrible photographs in for a Danish pop magazine or something, because we were trying in those days. We used to try to control. We tried to put forward a sort of an image, and we had very high quality control. And we've spent even now, battling about this kind of thing, because people always try to make you just fodder for television shows and stuff like that, and really you want to maintain your own integrity. And the Pet Shop Boys are probably still here after 25 years because we've pretty much maintained, although we've broken every rule we ever wrote, we've still pretty much maintained our integrity. And it's a struggle and it's a battle, and it's always been a struggle and a battle.
And there's been a point where you were like, this is just too much, you know, this is great.
There is sometimes, I just think, I can't, if there's a difficult way of doing it, that's the way we'll be doing it. But at the same time, it gives us an energy that feeds us.
And finally, we've had a whole list of firsts, so we're just left with the last song. What should we play? You get to choose. It can be something of yours. It can be something of someone else's. It can be a song that influenced you, or a song that's a favourite, or something new. It's your choice. What should we go out on?
Well, as we've been talking about us, I think we should end with our new single, because it's called Together.
Apt.
And it's actually not written about the Pet Shop Boys, but I think it's a song that's about two people who are going to do something very exciting, about the impact of two people together. So in that respect, it could be about the Pet Shop Boys' career as well.
It's been very good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Together we'll go on.
Whatever you want to. Six Music.
This is Six Music.